Welcome to the ESG Matters podcast. My name is Ahmad Gomes, and today my guest is Kate Gardner. She's an award-winning author, speaker, who's passionate about business circularity, and she has been recognized as one of the 50 global women in sustainability. She's also the founder and CEO of Triple Win Advisory. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Ahmad. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And thank you for joining. So maybe just to level set, can you discuss your career path and what led you to found Triple Win Advisory?
Gosh, how far back do you want me to go?
As far back as you want to.
Okay. I should say that I didn't start out with a sustainable mindset when I graduated from college. So it was a journey. I would say that when I graduated, I wanted to work for a bank, and I went to work for a retail bank in Boston doing tax reclamation. Boy, does that sound fun, right? Hated it and quickly decided, you know, maybe I should try my hand at consulting because it allows me to play in all these different industries and learn them. And I get bored easily. And I like to digest a lot of information. So I went into consulting, and I'm going to probably show my age, but I was at a time when I was working across a lot of industries, but I was mainly working within information technology. So technology companies and financial services companies, because they were more cutting edge, and they were trying to figure out how to monetize their internet channel, their digital channel. You can believe that. So people were trying to figure that out. I was there for a couple of years, and I decided to go back and get my MBA from the Wharton School, mainly because I really felt like I was doing a lot of research, learning about industries and presenting recommendations or suggestions, but I wasn't seeing how those companies were working, how they were implementing that work. And I thought that getting an MBA was going to give me that 360 business view. From there, digital was all the rage back then. This was 1999, 2000. And I decided to, after I worked for Reebok in their internet division between my first and second year of MBA. And then I came out and I just got this amazing job. I had been a athlete all my life. I played basketball in college. And so I had this amazing opportunity to work at Time Inc. on a brand new magazine, which was an extension of Sports Illustrated, and to be the general manager of their internet division, because I saw that, right, the rise of digital and that the younger generations were there and they wanted to digest information there. And I worked there for a year or two. I went on to work for Ziff Davis Media, managing some of their B2C digital assets, pc.mag.com and Extreme Tech. And then I loved the entertainment, the media and entertainment industry, but I jumped from publishing to work at XM Satellite Radio in their consumer marketing group. So that was XM was at that time was a $1 billion startup. They had shot two satellites into space, and they were trying to educate consumers and businesses, but at the time consumers, on this new idea of, you know, hey, radio without advertising, 100 channels, anywhere, you know, anything that you can choose, anywhere you wanted to listen to it. And so up to this point, I think the running theme for me was I liked entrepreneurial ventures, things that were moving fast, disruptive companies or technologies. But, you know, I had written a lot of business plans when I was at Wharton, and I just had this gut urge to start my own business. And I think this is where I get into sustainability. And I had this idea to start a women's sustainable activewear company where I would design, manufacture, and sell women's clothes and accessories that they would wear to go to Pilates or maybe to the gym, but definitely to do yoga. And I saw that there was a gap in the market. And I also saw that sustainability was coming around the bend pretty quickly. You were seeing it with furniture, so sustainable furniture and architecture, but you weren't really seeing it in textiles and clothing. And I said, you know, I don't have the brand power of an Adidas or a Nike. And I definitely don't have the cash flow of those organizations as well. But I see that sustainability is here. So I'm going to go all in. And I'm going to design clothes that only use sustainable fibers. And so that's where I jumped in the deep end. I did not know anything about manufacturing at the time. And so I had to source these different types of fabric and make them worthwhile to consumers that only knew supplex. They were wearing plastic. They were wearing petroleum to sweat and work out and make their bodies strong. And so that was, you know, I'm going to probably repeat that. Sustainability is about education, educating consumers about why it's important for themselves and for the earth, the planet. So I did that. I also built a flagship store in Brooklyn, New York, and New York City. And I hired an architect. We made it all fully sustainable. And then I also sold other products in there that were sustainable, organic, USDA certified organic, biodegradable, all natural. And it was a huge undertaking when people would come in and they wanted to shop by cost or by price. And I wanted to make sustainability affordable. But of course, there was a premium. And there was like, you know, it was constantly this conversation of just try, you know, and educating them. From there, I had that business for about 8 years. At the tail end of it, I had moved to Europe and was living in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. And I got to see firsthand how Europeans took and perceived sustainability at all levels of society, at the individual level, at the retail and industry level, and also at the municipal and nation state level. And they were taking it far more seriously than we in the United States. And that was an eye opener. And I decided then, like when I had the decision, like I wanted to learn more, a 360 view of business, decided in 2015-16 that I wanted to get a 360 view on sustainability, how the systems were interlinked, cultural, political, economic. And so I went back to get my master's of science in sustainable management at the University of Wisconsin. It was a multidisciplinary program. And I learned the basics, right? I learned about hydrology and about, you know, geology and weather systems. But they were, you know, they were interlinking. And I learned the opposite of about economics when I learned about economics at Wharton, about the perils of continuous growth. And so that was a huge eye-opener. And now I'm getting to answer your question. So I thought that when I was going to enter that master's program, that I would just get it, go into one organization and be their CSO, their chief sustainability officer. When I took that first semester, that economics, sustainable economics class, I knew that I couldn't do that, that my whole world had just blown up. And so I finished the master's program. I had moved back to the United States the year prior. So finished in 2017. I had moved back to the United States in August of 2016, never thinking that the White House would be occupied by the Trump administration. And I saw that people, Americans, were sitting back on their heels, waiting to be told what to do around the climate crisis and how to be sustainable. You had pockets in the United States that, in definitely, you know, New York and maybe Minnesota, definitely the West Coast, where they were taking charge. These states and these cities were taking charge and doing things around sustainability, but most of the rest of the United States wasn't. And so then it was, okay, I'm going to write a book and give individuals a framework for thinking about sustainability and how it relates to climate change and how and where they can take action for themselves and in their communities. And then I also established Triple Win Advisory because in my master's, knowing what I knew about manufacturing textiles, apparel, I knew that there was a lot more that we could be doing to make it better for the environment and better for societies and communities. So what I focused on learning about industrial ecology in my master's, but the framework for that is circularity, circular economy, circular manufacturing. And I decided that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work with consumer-facing, highly visible brand companies that were manufacturers of consumer products so that I could change how they design products, how they went to the market with those products, and what they did with the materials and products after the consumer was done with it.
Thank you for that. I think it's really important for people to understand that sometimes where you start and where you end up can be very different because you're always taking in new information, having new experiences that alter how you think, that alter your ideas, and that you mature in different ways. So it's really interesting to hear about your background from beginning to currently where it is now. And sort of thinking about where you are now, when you think about circular economy and the principles thereof, where do you see industries when it comes to this implementation of those principles?
Yeah, I'm so glad that you're asking this question. So the idea of circular economy or circular manufacturing is what I talk about a lot. In the public sphere, it's growing in awareness. People understand generally what it means and that it's necessary, but it's still an extremely nascent idea that has not reached its stride, right? So when we're talking about the implementation of circular economy principles at systemic levels, like industry levels, it's a new endeavor, and it's not really, it's been piloted, it's been commercialized, some of the technologies and ideas, but really the scale isn't there. So let me talk a little bit about that. And I'm gonna talk a lot about companies and the dates or the year they were founded, just to give people a perspective that this really is just a decades old idea of like, we need to adopt circular economy principles. Really, the founding organization on this idea of circular economy is the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. It's based out of the UK. It's a nonprofit founded in 2009. And they really, back then, the founder, Ellen MacArthur, but the foundation, they had a big megaphone. They were like, hey, we got to really pursue circularity. And they were talking to governments, industries, academic universities, and of course, individuals to say, hey, listen up, this is where we need to go. If I were to take my lead from NIST, which is NIST, it's an acronym that is for the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technologies. It's a mouthful. It's a non-regulatory science-focused agency within the Department of Commerce here in the federal government of the United States. They're focused on basically four different areas right now. They have a circular economy program that was established at the end of 2015, early 2016. So the four areas is polymers, which are really plastics, and that spans basically all industries, but they're really focused on textile. So think about your sheets and carpeting and also the clothes you wear, as well as all kind of packaging. The second one is they're focused on e-waste, electronic waste, and that's all our personal electronics as well as batteries, right? So batteries that we find in our electric vehicles, as well as like Tesla power walls, like backup generators that have batteries in them. The third one is concrete, cement. They do focus also on steel, but think the built environment, the built infrastructure, our buildings, our homes, our roads. And of course, they just recently added food and organic waste. So they're focused on those four areas that touch a little bit more industries. But why? Why those four areas? Well, I would argue that the reason why it's polymers or plastics and e-waste is because there is broad awareness of how much pollution is stacking up, right? In landfills and poor developing countries. I mean, we see these pictures of these people climbing these mountains of trash, and they're sitting there polluting our water, our air, and our land. And they're polluting people in their communities, right? So they're causing disease and death. And it is a huge issue of broad awareness that we need to do something about this. Plastics, So let's talk a little bit about plastics. So that there's a company out of New York. It's an investment firm called Closed Loop Partners, and they own the whole value chain of investing in circular systems and technologies and companies. They've done a lot of research on chemical recycling of plastics. This idea that it's not enough to mechanically break it down into resins so that we can reuse it because there's so much contamination. They have gotten into the municipal recycling business, right? The commercial recycling business, this is Closed Loop Partners. It's because our recycling system is broken and it needs to be profitable. And we also need to scale chemical recycling so we can commoditize these different plastics that are proliferating and keep them within the supply chain, right? All these man-made products, we just keep them in the supply chain. We keep on using them. So they're founded in 2014. When we think about textiles, so I don't know if your listeners know, but 70% of all clothing and textiles made globally are made using polyester, which is derived from natural gas and oil. And it's basically with a chemical process, they create fibers and threads, and then they make products from it. Well, what do we do with all of that, right? And so you've got companies out there such as Warnagen, which is a company that's based in the UK, one of the oldest companies that were founded. That was founded in 2005. You have Evernew, E-V-R-N-U, that's based out of Seattle, founded in 2014. And LoopedWorks, which is based here in Oregon, they used to just design products. They would take pre- and post-consumer manufacturing waste, try to eliminate it from going to landfill or incineration, and create new products. They've changed their business model in the last years to be more like Warnagen and Evernew. And they are adopting chemical recycling processes for textiles so that they can use that to create new products, keep it within the system. These companies, they're new. They've been around for less than 10 years. Warnagen, a little bit longer than that. But here's the thing. Warnagen is just going to open a demonstration plant of recycling textiles next year. They're not going to commercialize that plant until 2027. So again, it's a nascent industry. When we think about e-waste, we just have had movement in the last 2 years, right? So in October of 2021, France, first country in the globe, created what's called a repairability index. And so the issue, and this was driven by a company called ifixit.com here in the United States. It's been around for a long time. But that company, basically, they would put on YouTube these videos and they would say, hey, this is how you repair your personal electronics so you don't have to go out and buy something. It's pretty easy. We can show you how to do it. But what they were finding is that some companies made it really difficult to repair their personal electronics, almost impossible. And so they would report on that. They would say, you can't repair this. They've made it impossible. We don't have the right tools to even open up the system. And so iFixit worked with France to basically call these brands under the rug and say, you are making it impossible. You are promoting planned obsolescence. You are forcing people to buy products every year, every 2 years for your profit motive. And it's not helping us slow material throughput within the manufacturing system and to keep products good and healthy and working. So that was just created, that was just promulgated in October 2021. Also in 2021, around e-waste, you had what was a pact that came into existence called the Global Circular Electronics Partnership, or CEEP. And it's a series of technology companies like Cisco and Dell, along with some other ones, Google, Microsoft. And they are working together to support design and implementation of circular solutions for electronics. And the reason why is because there's so many valuable materials that are put into these electronics that are just being put into landfill, polluting our environment. Why not take them back, keep our cost structures low, put them back into electronics and have them continuously recycled? And we're thinking about that from an e-waste perspective. We're thinking about that from a plastics perspective. It's similar to the global aluminum and steel industry. 92% of aluminum and about 97 or 98% of steel, right, materials that retain their value and worth, are recycled. I do want to touch on concrete and cement and then food and organic waste. So these two other areas, concrete, because listen, there are going to be 2 to 3 billion more people on this earth by the end of the century. They need to be housed. They need to commute, right, back from their homes and work. Increasingly, these human populations are going to be urbanized, and we're not going to get away from using concrete and cement. So how do we make it better for the environment? And so right now, there are very few companies out there that are creating this mud, right? This cement that is a carbon capture mud, a carbon sequestration mud, where when you build a home, over time, that cement, concrete on roads, actually absorbs CO2 out of the atmosphere. But we have plants that are in existence, but they're not scaled to where we need them to be. And then lastly, the food and organic waste. I mean, listen, none of that should go into landfill where they off-gas methane, which is even more potent than carbon dioxide. And we also need to feed the world. There's 2 to 3 billion people today on the planet that go hungry, right? They have a lack of food and nourishment. That's going to only increase over the century. We have enough food that's produced in the world to feed all those people through this century. The problem is so much of it goes to waste or is lost. And so that's where you're seeing a lot of circular systems thinking happening. But again, you know, the companies that are working on it, WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, and ReFED and RAP, they were only established in 2015. Again, less than a decade of work in these areas.
So question about that, you know, when you've laid out a really good business case as to how nascent a lot of these nonprofits and a lot of the education and work around this has started and fairly recently, and how there's a lot of need for circularity. And, you know, one of the questions I have, right, is that at least in the United States, a lot of our economy is driven by what people say middle market or lower middle market companies. And I would say they're probably like the strategic suppliers of large Fortune 500 companies. And oftentimes they are not involved in this conversation when it comes to sustainability or circularity or any of these topics. And I'm curious from your perspective, where do you see them as a player in this field?
Another great question. One is they're being forced to do the hard work with less resources because these big companies, they're high profile. And their investors and their consumers and their employees are saying, hey, you got to really embrace corporate sustainability and circularity. And so they create these targets, which are called science-based targets, that are aligned with the Paris Climate Accord to keep global warming below a certain degree, right? And they, once they declare those goals, they are disclosing them broadly, publicly, but also to an organization called the CDP, the Carbon Disclosure Project. And that, as soon as a big, large company, mostly they're publicly held, discloses their science-based targets, there is a survey that goes out to all their vendors and suppliers, automatically almost, and says, hey, we know that you're a vendor and supplier, a potential client customer of this company. What are you doing around your carbon footprint? Have you conducted carbon inventory? Have you set science-based targets? Have you tried to optimize and build efficiency into your operations so you can mitigate your contributions to climate change? And so there is this trickle effect. Maybe what you're referring to also is the fact that, you know, our economies are driven by these smaller and medium-sized companies. And I think that fundamentally, there's a lot that they can do. And I think they're doing a lot. They're committing to being more than profit companies. They're B Lab members. They are social impact ventures. And the companies that are being founded by millennials and Gen Z individuals really want to only operate with a circular mindset or a very environmentally light mindset. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of companies I've worked with. So a company I worked with is a razor manufacturer, and they sell through Sephora nationwide. And they decided that they were going to be a fully circular organization. So they were going to only create durable, long-lasting metal razors and accessories. And they came to me and said, the problem with that is we're really thinking a lot about how we're designing our products, but still we want to ensure that our materials get back into the supply chain. And we have to help our consumers do that. Can you help us with that? And so I worked with them to build an end of consumer use collection system. And then found partners, right? When you think about circularity, it's about extending the supply chain or value chain, because you don't always own all of it, so that you can make the circle loop back and closed into the system. So helped find partners for them and then built the financial business case on what it would take, the processes and investment to put that program in place. There is a kombucha company. I'll give another example. There's a kombucha company I work with, and they put their tea product into glass bottles that were quite heavy. They were beautiful, and they felt good in the hand. But heavy makes emissions higher when you have to transport all of those bottles to markets. And so we did a carbon inventory for them, and we recommended a couple things to reduce their carbon emissions. One is to dematerialize, take some of that glass out of the bottles to make them lighter. How about also thinking about putting recycled glass content in those so that the carbon intensity of those, that glass, was less? And we said one of the better ways, even the best way, is to move away from glass altogether and put your drink in recycled aluminum. Because like I said, 92% of the global aluminum supply is recycled, and the carbon intensity is quite low, and it's reusable and it's valuable material. And so there are ways that they are really thinking about these small and medium-sized companies and how they create circular systems for the products that they put out in the market.
I really love those examples. And I think those are concrete ways in which companies that oftentimes feel that they are, that this conversation sort of flies over their head, that they can actually implement this in a way that speaks to their core strengths, as well as a key, becomes a key differentiator to some of their B2B clients and their B2C customers who really care about this and are really driven by this type of work. So I think that's really important. I think to wrap this up, a question I have for you, Kate, is if I'm a company or represent a company, how do I get in touch with you to leverage you and to procure your services?
So you can, the easiest way is to go to my website, which is www.triplewinadvisory.com. Of course, you can always reach out to me via email at Kate, K-A-T-E, at triplewinadvisory.com.
Well, thank you so much, Kate. I really enjoyed having you on the podcast, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.